Today we're going to have kind of a transition program between our most recent study in John's letters, his first, second, and third John letters, and his final writing, and actually the final writing of the entire scripture, the book of Revelation. And the reason I want to do this particular transition program is because it's about an event that is extremely important in the history of the world and the history of Scripture, and that would be the destruction of the temple at Jerusalem. Jesus predicted in his Olivet Discourse in the last few days of his life that the temple was going to be destroyed. And he referenced this to the book of Daniel, that the abomination of desolation was going to take place exactly as the book of Daniel said. In the book of Luke, chapter 21, verse 20, Luke, who is a Gentile and writing a gospel that he often doesn't use the exact words of Jesus, but instead uses synonyms or explanatory words. This is how he described the abomination of desolation. Luke 21, 20. When you see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, then recognize that her desolation is near. Then those who are in Judea must flee to the mountains, and those who are in the midst of the city must leave, and those who are in the country must not leave the city because, or must not enter the city, because these are days of vengeance, so that all things which are written will be fulfilled. Woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be a great distress upon the land and wrath to this people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all the nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So Luke makes it very plain, and I have taught this whenever we went through the Olivet Discourse earlier, that the destruction of Jerusalem was the beginning of this great tribulation, and that the abomination of desolation, contrary to what popular prophecy teachers teach nowadays, the abomination of desolation consisted of armies surrounding Jerusalem that would eventually destroy her. And so we need to talk about the fulfillment of that Olivet Discourse. The majority of the Olivet Discourse was about what happened leading up to and including AD 70 and the destruction of the Jerusalem temple. That event marked the final removal of Old Testament vestiges. And it's just so significant that I want us to kind of look through some of the historical record about this event and connect it to the prophecy that Jesus made and how it had an impact upon the church. Now, some of the background that we need to remember as we get into this, is that Nero was the emperor in AD 66 when the war that resulted in the destruction of the temple began. Now, Nero was not really personally involved in that war. Not really. I mean, he ordered some things to be done, but it was his representative living in Judea, the prefect of Judea, who really sparked things. This guy is a guy by the name of Florus. He was a rotten scoundrel. He had come to the conclusion that he might be able to get his hands on some of the wealth of the temple if he could just get the Jewish people to rebel against Roman rule, and then he could bring in legions, quash the rebellion, confiscate all the wealth out of the temple, and then he would get a certain percentage of that. But he was having a hard time trying to get these guys to fight back. In a lot of that is because of a person we already know from church history, and that would be King Agrippa II, along with his sister Bernice. These are the ones who were very religious, whom Paul spoke to shortly before going to Rome for his imperial review. He's the one that Paul tried to convert. Agrippa II even asked, you think you can convert me in such a short time to be a Christian? And Paul said, King, I don't care whether it's short or long. I wish everyone who's listening to me today would become like me, except for these chains. And so he was Agrippa II was a very religious Jewish person. And when he and his sister realized what Florus was up to, they tried to stop him, and Bernice almost was killed at one moment trying to stop him from stop some of his troops from getting the Jewish people to fight back. But when they realized it wasn't doing good to debate or deal with Florus, they instead turned their attention to the Jewish people because they could sense that, you know, you can only slap the Jewish people around so long before the populace is going to want to do something about it. And Josephus, who is the historian who provides so much of the information of this time period, and you really ought to have a copy of Josephus's writings. You can pick it up at any bookstore. He records King Agrippa's appeal to the populace of Jerusalem to just be patient, to go through channels and have Florus removed, and that he himself would try and work on this and to not try to fight against Rome because it would be folly to try to fight Rome. Well, the older leaders of Judea, the older Jewish leaders, and when I say older, I'm talking about probably in their 50s and up, they agreed with King Agrippa. They saw the sense that Florus would only get his way if they responded in kind to him, and that it would be better to work through channels and get him removed. Unfortunately, the younger set were more angry. They were more hot-headed, I suppose we would say nowadays. And they even threw stones at King Agrippa for suggesting to them that they should not respond to Florus. And so King Herod, try as he might, couldn't stop them from doing the things that really began the war. A young man, and when we say young, again, he might have been in his 40s, by the name of Eleazar bar Ananus. He was the son of the high priest of this time period. He was also the head of temple security. He convinced, and some of this might have been through pressure, he convinced the officiating priests in the temple to not offer Gentile sacrifices. Now, this had been a long-standing tradition that Gentiles could pay to have sacrifices offered to the God of the Jews. The Caesars had been doing this for a long time, having a daily sacrifice offered. The older leadership in the temple begged the officiating Jews to go ahead and offer these sacrifices regardless of what Eleazar said, because it would be an insult to the Romans not to do so. But Eleazar was quite persuasive, and so they quit offering the sacrifices. And Josephus said that this was pretty much the foundation of the war, because it was this that was used by Florus to point to the disrespect of the Jewish people to Roman ways. as you might expect, this caused a great break between the two Jewish opinions. And you have the senior leadership, the older leadership, who have control of a significant portion of the city of Jerusalem. But then you had this younger set, the ones that really wanted to fight. They were in control of the functions within the temple and the rest of the city of Jerusalem. And each side was trying to win the other side's territory so they could take over the entire Jerusalem city. The older ones were trying to do it to save Jerusalem, they thought, and the younger ones were doing it because they wanted independence from Rome. Well, there was at least 7 days of street fighting between these two groups in Jerusalem. And on the eighth day, Eliezer's group finally took control of the upper city, the place where the high priest's residence was and where a lot of the official buildings of Jerusalem were located. They immediately went in and they torched the archives of the Jewish nation. This was to wipe out all the debt. They did this, Josephus suggests, because they were hoping to get a lot of the poorer people to join in this revolution. And they were right. That did tend to get a lot of people on their side. 2 days after they torched the upper city, they took hold of the Antonia Fortress, which was the military fort on the northwest corner of the temple complex. The Roman forces and the Herodian forces, the loyal forces to the Jewish leadership, all retreated out of there back to the palaces that were located on the extreme western part of the city. And for all practical purposes, the rebels had control of Jerusalem at that point. But then things spun even farther out of control. There was another man by the name of Menachem who saw himself as being a better rebel leader. He rushed off to Masada, which was a fortress city down to the south and east of Jerusalem. He killed off the Roman patrol that was stationed there, broke into the armory, and then came back to Jerusalem and besieged the Herodian palace complex where all of those Roman soldiers and those Jewish people who didn't want to break ties with Rome. He let the Jewish people pass, although he did kill the high priest. Then they promised that the Romans could come out if they would just lay down their arms. And so the Romans did exactly that, and Menachem's forces just slaughtered the Romans. They just went back on their covenant. Around that same day, down on the coast at the capital city for the Roman people, a place called Caesarea or Caesarea, the Gentiles were responding negatively to all the news that was coming out of Jerusalem, and they killed 20,000 Jewish people on that day. And then Florus rounded up all the surviving Jewish people and sold them into slavery. And as you would expect, everything just went way downhill fast after that. It was Jew against Gentile everywhere across what we call the Holy Land today. Lots and lots of fighting, lots of death, property destruction. It was just out of control. At this point, the legate of Syria, that would be the Roman official in charge of the whole eastern end of the Mediterranean basin. This man, a man by the name of Cestius, took action. He marched his legion down into the area of Judea, hooked up with King Agrippa II, they worked their way through the outlying areas, pacifying each area for the next several months. Most of the time, the Jewish insurgents, as we would probably refer to them now, just kind of melted away. They just kind of retreated. This Roman force arrived in the area of Jerusalem just in time for the Feast of Tabernacles in AD 66. Agrippa II tried to talk the Jewish people at Tabernacles into stopping this revolt where it was at. He even promised on behalf of the Romans amnesty for pretty much everyone involved in the revolt. But it was all in vain, because when one small group under the leadership of a very prominent Jewish person tried to surrender the city to the Roman control again, the Jewish people grabbed him and killed him. And that just kind of put an end to that attempt to bring peace to this situation. When the Feast of Tabernacles was over, so we're talking about in late October of that particular year, Cestius, the Roman leader, moved his military encampment right down next to the city of Jerusalem on a place called Mount Scopus, which is just north and a little bit west of the city walls. Everybody in Jerusalem could have seen the encampments, and this was the trigger event that Jesus was referring to in his Olivet Discourse, which I already read from the book of Luke. When you see military encampments where they don't belong in the holy place, that would be the holy mountain on which Jerusalem was built, you are to get out of town. And that's what the historians tell us, is that all the Jewish believers in Jesus, they got out of town. You see, when Cestius set up his encampment there, for the next 3 days he did nothing. Josephus reports that the reason he did this was to give opportunity for the Jewish people to think through the consequences that lay ahead if they didn't give up. And so we know from this that because they paid attention to the prophecy of Jesus about these military encampments, all the Jewish believers in Jesus got out of town and they didn't die in what happened next. Now, it took several more years for that to happen, but it did eventually happen. After about 3 days, as I said, Cestius' forces went ahead and they moved into the city of Jerusalem. The Jewish forces that were trying to resist retreated back into the temple area and just kind of dug in into the temple. For the next 2 weeks, Cestius had very limited military engagements with the Jewish forces. And Josephus says that if he had just pushed ahead, as you would expect a Roman general to do when he has the advantage like he had, everything would have ended at that point. But Josephus seems to be of the opinion that God wanted something different than that. And I would have to agree with him that there was a prophecy to be fulfilled here, that there was wrath that was going to be fulfilled against the people who had rejected and executed his son as their Messiah, and that this was coming to the fulfillment of the wrath of God upon this city. Cestius, for reasons we do not understand, suddenly decided that he was going to pull his forces out of Jerusalem. When he tried to do that, the Jewish insurgents, the Jewish rebels, started picking off his Roman troopers on the fringes and on the tail of his formation. Each time he tried to move further away from Jerusalem, the more they sniped. He then tried to take them all the way down to the coast, and he took them by way of the main road. And the Jewish rebels, the Jewish soldiers who were starting to get more and more brazen, more and more bold, began coming down off of the hills and shooting off of the hills with arrows upon the force that was trying to retreat. And they would even make little runs at weak points in the column. By the time that Cestius got his forces quite a ways to the coast, he had lost a huge number of them. And then he did a by-night retreat, trying to break for the coast. And during that night, it was an absolute disaster. There were only a few hundred men left in his legion, which a full legion was over 6,000 personnel. There were only a few hundred of the 12th Legion left alive by the time they reached Caesarea on the coast and the protection of the Roman military encampments there. Josephus records at this point that that the most eminent Jewish leaders, the most eminent Jewish citizens of Rome, abandoned the city of Jerusalem like swimmers deserting a sinking ship. That's a direct quote from Wars, book number 2. And you can imagine why they did that. For the Jewish people to annihilate a legion could not go unanswered. Now, Cestius tried to blame everything on Florus, but many of the other politicians and those who were aware of what happened, they were just as angry with Cestius for being such a fool militarily and losing the advantage like he did. Now, Nero had to do something. Josephus reports that Nero tried to play everything down, that it wasn't all that big of a deal. But inwardly, he knew it was a big deal. This was a huge loss for the Roman military. And he was already concerned about other areas of weakness in his empire. And so he had to take care of this in a way that would be decisive. He didn't trust everyone in leadership. He was very concerned that there were a lot of politicians in military leadership. So he searched around until he finally lit upon a man that he trusted to get this job done. That man was a man by the name of Vespasian. Now, Vespasian was well known as a strategist, as a great tactician. He is the man that had pacified the Germanic border area for the Roman Empire. He had brought peace along the Rhine so that the German tribes were not causing undue pressure upon that part of the Roman Empire. And he had even added the southern part of the island of Britain to the Roman Empire. This is the man that Nero tapped to go to the Far East and deal with this issue. So Vespasian gathered up a huge military force, And he commenced military operations in the winter of AD 66-67. So just only a matter of months after the defeat of the 12th Legion by the Roman or by the Jewish rebels. By the spring of AD 69, he was ready to assault the city of Jerusalem itself. He'd pretty much pacified all the outlying regions, and he had most of the troublemakers, as far as Rome was concerned, bottled up in the Jerusalem area. Now, during that same time, there was a lot of changes inside the rebel structure. They were fighting amongst themselves big time, and there's a lot of shifts. And I'm not going to go into all those details. But Vespasian didn't immediately begin his assault upon the city of Jerusalem because this was the time where great turmoil was going on in Rome itself. Nero had suicided in the summer of 68, and then there was a fight for who was going to be the next emperor. In July of 69, Vespasian had become a claimant to that position. His legion forces had decided that he was a much better person to lead the empire than the others that had been claiming that they should get the job. And so he kind of laid off of his military operations against Jerusalem until that was settled. He kept them bottled up in the Jerusalem area, but he didn't go in and attack it. By late winter of AD 69-70, he was the new emperor. And one of the first acts that he took was to order his son Titus to go and finish the war against Jerusalem. And next time we get together, we will talk about how that fulfilled much of what Jesus predicted in the Olivet Discourse.